Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
My name is Linda Vita. I'm the director of the Water Resources Center Archives on the Berkeley campus, and we're the major sponsor of this colloquium series. And tonight we're very excited because we are filming this lecture to be shown on UCTV. So this is the first time we're trying this. We plan to do this once each semester. With that, I'd like to introduce Professor Nara Simon, who will introduce our speaker for the evening.
Thank you, Linda. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce today's speaker, Professor Andy Fisher from UC Santa Cruz. He's going to talk about recharge of groundwater into the Pajaro groundwater basin in the Monterey Peninsula. And you will all find out that's very interesting. But I'm going to say something else about water and Andy. Water, you know, is so fascinating. It has so many dimensions that he actually started his career with his PhD thesis about groundwater not on land but under the oceans. He has spent a lot of time, and he continues to spend a lot of time, studying the circulation of water deep under the oceans in the oceanic crust. In fact, I just now asked him how his work on oceans was coming. He said most of his students are working on land, but that he just now got a big project which has been waiting for 6 years to go and do, believe it or not, aquifer tests under 10,000 feet of water beneath the Pacific Ocean. It may be very esoteric, but this is fascinating science. So when he does groundwater work in Monterey Peninsula, it's a remarkable combination of basic research coming from very esoteric type of situations and then applying it to practical problems. That's what academia is all about. That's what drives us all with this sort of thing. So I'm sure that you will see some of that showing up in what he is going to present today. Andy?
Thanks, Nari. Well, thank you all for coming. It's a great crowd, and I'm really pleased to be here. The presentation I'm going to make tonight is really a combination of four different talks that I've plucked slides and concepts from and then melded them together, hopefully to tell a complete story. And Linda encouraged me to challenge the audience. So I took her advice to heart, and there'll be parts of this talk that are a little bit esoteric. There's a little bit of math, there's a little bit of chemistry. And I'll tell you when those are coming, and you can pull out your Blackberries and get busy if you decide you don't want to pay attention to that. But hopefully I'll move right back into the concepts quickly enough that folks who aren't necessarily interested in those details will still get the main story. I'm going to acknowledge a number of folks. Actually, I should start by acknowledging two of my senior grad students, Kalla Schmidt and Andrew Race, who I was out in the field with yesterday, and they're out in the field today putting instruments in, and they couldn't be here this evening, but I'm presenting some of their results, all of which is unpublished work on our studies of managed aquifer for recharge. I'll also acknowledge a variety of collaborators here and a number of undergraduate student researchers who have worked with our group and done theses in our lab and just provided general lab and field support, and then a variety of sources for funding, in-kind support, and collaboration on the project. Okay, moving along then. Here's an overview of the presentation. I'll give you a quick introduction to groundwater in the Pajaro Valley in central coastal California. I'm going to start, though, with the state overall, just a few key points that probably some of you know about, but maybe not everybody knows about. I'll introduce the concept of managed aquifer recharge, and then the heart of the talk is going to be some scientific presentation of research that we've done in collaboration with a local water agency on a tool that's being used to put more water into the ground for use by growers and local citizens in the Pajaro Valley. then describe what we were working on yesterday and today. I've actually got some sort of new pictures to show what we're doing to try to enhance managed aquifer recharge in this system, and then I'll summarize and offer some conclusions. Well, California leads the nation in many things, including groundwater use. This is a compilation that the USGS puts together about every 5 years. And kind of the canonical numbers for California are that in a normal year, we use about 40% groundwater to satisfy freshwater demand in the state of California. And during a dry year, when the rivers are low and the reservoirs are low, that number typically rises to about 60%. And this obviously varies place by place and year by year, but these are sort of the typical numbers people describe. And, of course, the challenge in California is that most of the rainfall is falling in the northern part of the state, and most of the people and most of the freshwater demand is in the southern part of the state. And so in response to that, of course, California has built the most complicated, expensive, successful water redistribution system in the world. And I've seen different numbers. The last number I saw from the California Energy Commission said that 8 to 10% of our electricity in the state of California is spent moving water around and preparing it for distribution. Again, how you count those numbers will indicate what you come up with. But that's a lot of energy being used to move water around California. I'll point out, though, that the Central Coast Hydrologic Region, one of 10 major hydrologic regions in the state that DWR uses to sort of describe the different water environments, the Central Coast region is virtually disconnected from the state redistribution system. And in fact, I'm not sure this San Felipe connection is even as large as is shown there. So it's an interesting case study for California because in many ways it's a part of the state that's virtually off the grid in terms of California statewide water redistribution. When I arrived, soon after I arrived at Santa Cruz, I was introduced to the water plan updates, the Bulletin 160 that's put out by DWR every 5 years. And this was one from 1998 that came out soon after I arrived. And I remember reading through this and pulling slides together for my hydrology class. And here's what they said was going on in 98, and these were the projections that they made for 2020 at that time. They used conditions from 95 as sort of a baseline, and they had a normal 95 and a dry 95. And they totaled up supply and demand, and they're shown here. What they said was, this is as of 98, that during a normal water year, the state runs a deficit of 1.6 million acre feet. So an acre foot is 200 feet by 200 feet by 1 foot deep. It's about enough water for two families of four for a year. So this is the water deficit, okay, in a normal year as of 98. Enough water for 3.2 million families, okay, just to give you an idea of what that number is like, how big it is. And during dry year conditions, DWR said that the deficit was about three times that size, was about 5 million acre feet. And the projection in this water plan update was that by 2020, which is 25 years later, that this deficit during the normal year would be driven almost to zero, and the dry year deficit would be cut in half. In the same bulletin, DWR projected a 50% increase in population. Okay, so one might wonder, how can it be that we're going to add 50% more people and yet use half as much water or an eighth as much water? It's the volume. I don't know. I don't know what the basis was for that. But now, how are we doing, right? I mean, that was the 98 report. Here it is. It's 10 years later. We're living in the future, right? So let's jump ahead and look at the next water plan update. Came out 2005. And see where things stand now that we're halfway to our goal, at least in terms of time and population. Right? Now, in the 2005 update, they included environmental uses, so all the numbers got bigger because the in-stream flows were included in their totals. Now, however, the normal year deficit is almost 6 million acre feet, okay, three times the size. So we're not reducing our demand sufficiently to make up for the available supply with the increasing population. In fact, things are getting worse. And if you look at the 2001 dry year projection, it's about 14 million acre feet. So just again, to put that in perspective, that's enough water for 28 million families. That's the deficit, not the use, the deficit. Okay. And interestingly, in 2005, this was the first water plan update that had a significant mention of climate change. And No climate change projections were used for any of these calculations. They mentioned that climate change may occur, but they weren't actually using any climate change projections, like 90% loss of Sierra snowpack, for example. Okay, not included in this. And if you think maybe things have gotten better now, I took a quick look last week at the 2009 draft update, which you can get at the DWR website. And they showed even for 2005, for a year when the precipitation was 25% above normal, our deficit is still about that in the projection, about 5 million acre feet. So we're 60% of the way from 1995 to 2020, and things are not getting better in the state of California in terms of water supply. Now, DWR does not call this overdraft, but we know that when we overspend and generate a money deficit in the United States of America, the government can print money, right? That's we sell bonds, we print money. That's how we make up our deficit spending. But there's no way to print water in California, and you can't keep taking millions of acre feet out of streams and reservoirs that don't have them. So much of this has to be overdraft. It has to be. The last DWR overdraft estimate is about 10 years old. At the time, they said it was about 1 to 2 million acre feet a year. But the fact is nobody knows because, as probably most of you guys know, there's no statutory groundwater law in California for general management. There's no statewide metering. Nobody actually knows how much water is being used, is the reality. So it wouldn't surprise me if this was close to the statewide overdraft for groundwater. This is a huge statewide problem. And just for another point of reference, you may remember, I think it was about 18 months ago, Governor Schwarzenegger mentioned the possibility of building two new dam projects that would have supplied a total of about 750,000 acre feet, so not even close to addressing the overdraft. And he pretty much stopped talking about those after a day, right? There was so much upset about the idea of building new big dams that it's kind of still in play as a possibility, but as a practical matter, it doesn't seem politically viable. There's no way that we are going to dam our way out of this. Okay? So we know that much of the excess use of water in California is groundwater overdraft, and we know that we're not going to solve this problem with surface water. That's not going to happen. Now, DWR also in their 2005 update made some projections. They said, well, how are we going to satisfy this need that we see, the need we have now and the need going forward? And these were their estimates of potential sources of fresh water. And number one with a bullet was urban water use efficiency. But number two was what they called conjunctive management and groundwater storage. And so what they're talking about here is a variety of approaches, a variety of topics, one of which I'll address in the presentation today. But I'd argue one thing we know from this introduction, one thing we know going forward is that groundwater is going to become increasingly important in California. It has to be, because there's no other options that are going to be available. When the snowpack is gone and the rivers and reservoirs are dry, there will be no other choices except finding better ways to use groundwater. So this is happening, and it's coming right now. Okay, so a few general groundwater concepts, because they'll come up during the rest of the talk. Sustainable yield, sometimes called safe yield or basin yield, it's the amount of water that one can pump from an aquifer for a long period of time without causing some unacceptable harm. This is not a hydrologic definition. Okay? The term isn't hydrologic. It's economic, it's social, it's political, it's practical. There's hydrology involved, but it's fundamentally a decision about how much harm is unacceptable. Well, now we have overdraft. Right, so I will talk about sustainable yield and overdraft in this presentation. The overdraft definition ties directly back because you're overdrafting when you're in a developed groundwater basin, and the amount of pumping along with all of the other outputs to the basin causes one to exceed the sustainable yield of the basin. Okay, so you can't define overdraft without defining this term, and this term is kind of a cagey one. It's one that people argue about a lot, but unfortunately, it can't really be defined hydrologically. So what's clear is that in order to define an overdraft condition, we need to say something about sustainable yield, and I'll do that a little bit later on today. When a basin is in overdraft, when more water is coming out than can be handled without leading to unacceptable harm, then a variety of things can occur. I'll talk a little bit about seawater intrusion in the Pajaro Valley, salty water moving in, but there's a variety of other other detrimental impacts that are well documented in many basins, including subsidence. One that's not appreciated is a permanent or quasi-permanent loss of storage, that the open spaces in the aquifer can actually be lost if there's consolidation of the aquifer because water's removed. And that's a non-recoverable loss of space when that occurs. Big impacts on surface water, on wetlands and streams, the developments of dry gaps, and also from a variety of causes, water quality can be impacted as well. So let's look at the central coastal area of California. I work here at the UC Santa Cruz at the northern end of the bay. This is the Pajaro Valley. We'll look at that in a little more detail. Right in the middle of the bay, halfway between Santa Cruz and Monterey. This map is one that DWR put out in the 98 update, and what it shows is groundwater use in millions of acre feet in each of the different regions of the state. But the number I want to focus on is the fraction of water supplied by groundwater. And the Central Coast region, this is the part of the state that's the least connected to the statewide water distribution system. Central Coast gets about 83% of its freshwater supply from groundwater. It's more than any other part of the state has a fraction of water supply through groundwater pumping. Other parts of the state use a lot more water, but they depend proportionately more on surface water. And I think this offers a lot of opportunities for the Central Coast region to really be a leader, to explore and develop tools and techniques and to lead in terms of maximizing use of limited groundwater resources in a way that is sustainable. So zooming in now, here's Monterey Bay. The area shown in purple here is the drainage basin for the Pajaro River. This is a basin area of about 3,400 square kilometers. It includes Santa Cruz County here, but also parts of Monterey County, Santa Clara County, and San Benito County. This is the San Andreas Fault, which is kind of the backstop for the Pajaro Valley. And oceanward of the fault, here is the Pajaro Valley groundwater basin. It includes mostly Santa Cruz County, a little bit of Monterey County, tiny bit of San Benito County here. In the Pajaro Valley, the primary water use is for agriculture. About 85% of the water pumped in the basin supports crops. Many of these are high-value crops, things like strawberries and caneberries. It's also a center for high-value organic agriculture, and it's some of the most productive farmland in the state. The US EPA considers many surface water systems in the Pajaro Valley to be impaired with respect to sediment, nutrients, and pesticides. This includes the Pajaro River, the Watsonville Sloughs, and a variety of other smaller wetland systems, water systems around the area. Virtually all of the freshwater use in the Pajaro Valley is supported by pumping groundwater. There's a little bit of surface diversion, but not very much. And right now, the groundwater extraction in the Pajaro Valley exceeds the sustainable yield of the basin, and that's been going on for at least 30 years, maybe more like 50 years. The last figure here shows an A to A prime, and this is a figure I modified from my friend Greg Stemler's master's thesis, and it shows a cross-section of the geology through the Pajaro Valley. The main aquifer is this unit here called the Aromas Formation. It's about 60 meters thick here on the eastern side of the basin, but it gets to several hundred meters thick in the center of the basin and as you go towards the ocean. It's a very transmissive aquifer. Farther towards the basin edges, both to the east and to the north, we have the Purissima Formation, which is a finer-grained, typically layered marine sequence of sand, silt, and claystones. Scattered throughout these main aquifer units are a variety of clay layers, some of them thick, some of them thin, mostly discontinuous, some of them spreading across the basin. But in fact, in many cases, there are gaps in the clay layers, which is what allows recharge to occur as water soaks in from rain and from other sources. There's been a lot of time and energy spent on trying to figure out how much water is pumped in the Pajaro Valley, what the sustainable yield of the basin is, and what the overdraft is. And I'm just going to finesse this a little bit by saying that it doesn't really matter what the exact numbers are. We know, because water levels in the basin have been going down for three or four decades, that the basin is overdrafted. And whether or not the sustainable yield is 20,000 acre feet or 50,000 acre feet depends largely on your definition of what's unacceptable harm. So rather than get into that, I'll just say that the sustainable yield is something in this range. The total pumpage in the basin is on the order of 70, maybe 75,000 acre feet per year. So the overdraft is on the order of 20 to 40,000 acre feet. It could be as much as 60% of the pumpage in the basin is overdraft. The The occurrence of overdraft in the basin has led to a number of problems, and the most obvious of which is seawater intrusion. And this is a map that shows in red an area where high salt content in wells has been denoted by the Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency. Now, the exact location of where the edge of this line should be drawn varies in detail. It varies because of the geology. It varies seasonally. It varies on a decadal cycle. It varies because of distribution of pumping in the basin. Okay, so there's a little municipal right here that has really, really nice water, but that's because they're drawing their water from a part of the aquifer that may be on a paleo channel below the surface where recharge occurring here just flows right to the ocean. So there's lots of little differences around the basin. But in general, the seawater intrusion is occurring at around 100 to 250 feet per year. Number of wells along the coast that used to supply water to productive farmland have been shut off. They can no longer pump from the Aromas Aquifer because once the salt content reaches 500 or 1,000 parts per million, that water is virtually unusable for the kinds of crops that are grown in the Pajaro Valley. The magnitude, the timing, the distribution of groundwater recharge is poorly known. This is a special act district where they do have some information on pumpage, but the total amount of water pumped from the Pajaro Valley isn't well understood. And we know even less about where groundwater recharge occurs. Most likely, it occurs in the following places: around the feather edges of the basin, where you have higher elevations, so there's an orographic effect. And as the clouds move up over the hills, then you get a little bit more rain. That Aromas Aquifer may daylight in some of those areas. There are agricultural returns all throughout the basin, so there are inefficiencies in irrigation, and some of that water percolates into the ground and serves as a form of groundwater recharge. There's evidence that there is some interbasin flow here from the north, but also water recharges from streams. And in some studies that I'm not going to get a chance to show you because I don't have time, students and I looked at this section of the Pajaro River and this section of Coralitos Creek, and particularly right here in a 3-kilometer section of the Pajaro River and in this section of Coralitos Creek, there's something like 25 to 30% of the sustainable basin yield can be accounted for as recharge through those sections of the streams. These are losing sections of the streams. It's on the order of 5 to 10,000 acre-feet here and probably 2 to 7,000 acre-feet there. And that's determined by direct measurements, by gauging and by accounting for inputs and outputs and doing a mass balance on the streams. But that's only a fraction of the recharge. Where the rest of the recharge occurs is not well understood. So I've just described a natural recharge process from precipitation, from irrigation, from stream beds, but there's a whole other world of groundwater recharge that I'm going to focus on for the rest of the presentation, and this is what's known as managed recharge. You can divide it into two general categories, that using wells and that using surface structures. And this is the one that's commonly referred to as managed aquifer recharge, or MAR. Some of the jargon that's used for these different forms of managed recharge is inconsistent. There's another kind known as aquifer storage recovery, or ASR. The USGS refers to all of this as ASR, so it can be a little bit confusing. But what I'm going to talk about is using surface water as artificial recharge for groundwater systems. There's also a whole class of recharge types that involves management of groundwater, things like in-lieu recharge, providing a new supply instead of pumping groundwater, or conjunctive use where a basin or several basins will trade off between surface and groundwater supplies in order to manage. So there are many advantages to enhancing groundwater storage, to managing recharge. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but I'll just mention a couple of them. Perhaps it's the only silver lining in the overdraft story is with all the overdraft, we're creating lots of space. Okay, so there's empty space in the ground which can be filled by recharging more groundwater. In many cases, that water quality that is recharged can improve the quality of what's there in the ground. And another big advantage, especially in a state where land is expensive, is that you get a multiplier effect in terms of the area that's involved. If you want to store 2 or 3,000 acre-feet in a dam, you need a pretty large area for the reservoir. But if you want to put 2 or 3,000 acre-feet in the ground, you'll probably only need about 7 or 8 acres because you get a multiplication effect because you can put so much water through that recharge pond. And I'll show you an example of that in a little bit. There's other advantages, but the one I'm going to point to here is one that I think is really important to not lose sight of, and that is that managed recharge is a local solution. And people with different political and economic perspectives can often get together and get behind this solution because it's a local solution, not requiring that water be brought in from another basin or a whole lot of money be spent to pump water from another part of the state. But there are trade-offs. There's no free lunch, and managed recharge requires infrastructure. Groundwater is notorious for not staying put, so that you don't get all the water back out that you put in. It's not like having an underground storage tank. It's in motion. There are political and legal issues with separating the water that's added from the water that was already there, deciding whose water is whose, and so forth. And again, one more that I'll just mention because I think it's one we shouldn't forget about, which is you can't see groundwater. And it means that there are issues of trust as to whether or not the water is really there and whether or not we'll be able to count on it in future years. And we shouldn't underestimate the value of being able to see a bunch of water in a reservoir behind a dam. It gives people a feeling of confidence to see that water. And we lose that a little bit with groundwater. Okay, so here's some examples from a USGS website that shows different kinds of managed recharge. Here's one where a well is used to induce flow into a groundwater aquifer. That's not what the Harkin Slough project looks like. Harkin Slough looks more like this. There's a recharge basin, and in this case, water is diverted from a surface supply, which is a local wetland. It's put into the basin, and then it seeps into the ground, where in the case of Harkin Slough, it's supposed to perch on top of a shallow confining layer above the main aquifer system. It's because of this perch layer that the Water Agency was given a special permit that they could introduce water into the ground that wasn't necessarily the highest quality water. Okay, this is an agriculturally developed area. It's being done in a part of the basin where the water quality is already quite poor. And in fact, the water that's being added is better than the ambient groundwater, but it's not drinking water quality. And normally, there are very, very tight rules on this sort of thing with adding water to a sole source aquifer. But this shows geometrically what's going on at the Harkin Slough aquifer recharge system. And I'll predict that in the next 20 years, you're going to see a lot more systems like this all over the state of California. So now zooming in, let's look at that system. Here's the city of Watsonville. Here's Monterey Bay, shown here. The little green areas here are the Watsonville sloughs. The largest one is Harkin Slough up here. And here's the managed aquifer recharge pond. And that's shown over here. I'll give you an aerial photo of that. So here's the Watsonville sloughs. Right at the intersection of Harkin Slough and Watsonville Slough, there's a pump. And when the water levels in Harkin Slough are high enough and the water quality is good enough, that water is piped. It goes through a filter system, and it's piped over to this pond. And this is a blow-up of that pond area. It has an area of about 7 acres. The squares are recovery wells that go down into the shallow aquifer below. And these stars are important here. These are monitoring wells. This system's unusual in that the agency had the foresight to put in a bunch of monitoring wells around the system, arranged kind of in a radial pattern away from the pond. And that allows access to that water to figure out where the water's going and what kind of influence the recharge has on water quality. You'll also see a bunch of instruments shown here, and you'll see more pictures of this. These are places where we've sampled soils or water or made other measurements in that pond. And a bunch of the figures I'm going to show you show the outline here. And that's just a cartoon schematic showing the limit of the pond at its highest water level. In the middle, it's about 20 feet deep when it's fully full, and on the edges, it's about 2 or 3 feet deep. So the Water Agency has a permit to divert up to 2,000 acre feet. So that's about 8% of what the basin management plan said was the sustainable yield of the basin. It's not an insignificant amount of water, but it's not a huge amount either. Over in Santa Clara, they recharge 125,000 acre feet through their spreading system. So it's a pretty small one, but it's a small basin. And that water is then recovered later using these recovery wells, and they use a coastal distribution pipeline to give that water or sell that water to local growers. And it's being used now by growers whose regular wells have been shut off because of the seawater intrusion problem. So here we are on the road that goes alongside of that pond, and here's what the pond looks like after it's been groomed for use in the fall. The agency goes in, scrapes the bottom, rips and disks, gets the ground turned over so it's ready for percolation. And then after the rain begins, in the wintertime, when the water level's high enough in Harkin Slough, water's diverted into that pond. And they can get up to about 15 acre feet a day into that pond, and it percolates through the bottom of the pond and then into the underlying shallow aquifer. It's been operated since 2001, and it's part of a much broader effort, including a water recycling plant, the coastal pipeline, and other measures that are being taken to bring the basin back into balance. Typically, the pond is operated until either the water quality or water levels are too low in Harkin Slough or percolation stops, and I'll be talking about that in the rest of the talk. So we had a number of questions that we wanted to understand in terms of how this system is operated. In the case of the Harkin Slough system, and in fact in the case of most managed recharge systems, percolation doesn't continue at a high rate indefinitely. Usually these systems operate for a period of weeks or months at a very high percolation rate, and then they slow down. And typically with a really big system, like some of the huge ones they have in Arizona, they'll shut off the ponds sequentially and they'll move through, dry them out, scrape them, reactivate them, start them up again. In this case, it's just run annually. So they'll run the pond till it stops running, and then they'll turn it off for the year, and then they'll clean it up for the next year. So we want to understand why is it that we seem to get this pattern where the percolation drops off after about 1 to 2 months. We want to know where the water is going below the pond and what is the efficiency of the recovery. Because if, in fact, some of that water is going into the deeper aquifer, then it might not be surprising that the agency is not able to get as much back out of the ground as they thought they would from the shallow aquifer. We're also looking at water quality, and I'll show you a little bit of data from that. And in particular, we're interested in quantifying nutrient load reduction that could be achieved through this approach, because surface water is often managed in basins to limit the export of nutrients. And if it turns out through operation of systems like this, some of those nutrients can be removed during recharge, then it seems like this could be a case where there are joint benefits, where you can improve water quality and increase water supply. So I'm going to touch on a few of these topics, but we're not going to have time to get into all of them. Here's the pond in 2008, and here's the distribution of areas that we sampled and monitored. Most of our monitoring work was done in this array of locations that are shown here. I'm going to focus in on one particular kind of measurement, and that is thermal measurements that we make to quantify the rate of recharge. First, though, I'm going to go over how we determine the total flow of water through the pond. We do a mass balance on the pond where we add up the amount of water put in, the diversions, precipitation, evaporation, and then we quantify the change in volume of storage by monitoring the water level. And through that, we can calculate the seepage, that is, the rate of infiltration into the ground. And to make that measurement, we did a very detailed LIDAR survey to create a digital elevation model of the pond at high resolution. And then we could create a rating curve that shows how the pond elevation, which is easy to measure, relates to the amount of water being stored, which is hard to measure. So now we can measure the pond level at every 15 minutes to a millimeter, and we can determine every 15 minutes how much water is stored there and do the mass balance calculation. And when we do that, here's what we find. The seepage rate is shown here in blue, and the stage, the water level in the pond, is shown here in black. This is from 2008. It's about 6 months of data. And you can see that they turned the pond on briefly, then they let the pumps go off. The water quality wasn't quite there. After a couple more rainstorms, they turned the pumps back on again, brought the level up, and kept it up for about 4 months. The seepage rate here is normalized to the area of the pond. So we calculate the total infiltration rate, divide by the area of the pond, and we get the seepage rate. And it peaks initially at about a meter a day. It's pretty fast for groundwater flow. That lasts for about a month. It then slows down, gets down to about 0.2 meters a day. That lasts for about 2 months, slows down to about 0.05 meters a day, and then finally they stop operating the pond late in the year when the percolation essentially ends. But that's the average. What's actually going on in the bottom of the pond? To figure that out, we use this thermal method that we've developed and modified at Santa Cruz. And I'm going to go through a few of the technical aspects of this for those who are interested. So this is your first call to pull out your BlackBerry or something if you don't want to see any math, because here it comes. We have these thermal instruments, and we hang these in the base of the pond inside piezometers. And the piezometers are filled with water. In this example that's shown here, there's a screen, but in fact, the ones we use now are just tubes that we fill with water. And in essence, these sensors then monitor the thermal condition in the formation around the piezometer. And what they measure are changes in water temperature with depth. And so typically, you might have a temperature in the pond that goes up and down just with diurnal temperature changes. Just from the difference in solar insolation day to nighttime, we get a couple degrees temperature difference. And as you go deeper into the pond, that temperature difference is subdued in amplitude, and it's shifted in phase. There's a delay in the arrival of the peaks and the troughs the deeper you go into the pond. So this is the mathematical equation that describes the transfer of heat down through the base of the pond. And you don't need to know what what all the symbols are or how to solve it to understand the concept. The idea is we measure temperature changes over time at different depths, and we can calculate then what the seepage rate is, which is the fluid velocity right here, based on that thermal response. Because the faster the water flows downward, the more that amplitude of temperature changes will be swept along with the water. Okay? And what we really want to solve for is that flow rate, right? The rate of which water moves into the bottom of the pond. So it turns out with the appropriate boundary and initial conditions, that equation can be solved, and it looks like this. It's kind of hideous looking, but it's actually not so bad. What's cool about this result, and the reason I'm showing you the equation, is it has two parts. There's an amplitude part. That's how high the peaks and troughs are, how far apart they're separated from each other. And there's a completely separate phase part. That's how the different peaks at different depths are separated in time. So in essence, by measuring the difference in temperature at two different depths and measuring how those daily temperature changes vary and how they shift, we can determine the flow rate without Darcy's law, without measuring pressure, without any other measurements. What we want to solve for is this term here, the velocity of the fluid. So we can take those two equations and then break them up. Here's the amplitude part. Here's the phase part. And they both have a velocity in them. Okay. So we solve for the velocity. That's what these equations are. And these are the ones we actually use to do our calculations. We get one estimate of the flow rate from the amplitude change, and we get one estimate of the flow rate from the change in phase. It turns out, to do this, you have to iterate. You have to guess a number, solve, guess a number, solve, because velocity appears on both sides. It also appears here, but it's rolled up into this term, this alpha term. Okay. But it's actually mathematically not hard to do. It's coded up in a pretty small computer program, and we can solve for the fluid velocity based on the temperatures. But there's one more thing we have to do, and that's apply a filter to the data. We have to filter out everything except the diurnal signal. And I'll show you that in a minute. Here's what that amplitude signal looks like, just to show you this is not so scary. This equation looks like this. Okay? That's it. It's not so bad. And what it says is when you've got downward seepage, that's a negative number, the amplitude at depth looks very much like the amplitude at the top. If you have upward flow, it's the opposite. You get no signal penetrating downward. And it's a monotonic relationship. So if we measure the amplitude ratio, we just walk across and go down, and that's the seepage rate. Okay? And that's what we do with that program to calculate what the flow rates are. There's a similar calculation for phase, but I'm not going to go into that. So here's an example of some data from the Pajaro River. There's actually two thermal records in here. You just can't see them because they're virtually on top of each other. This is 6 months of data from the Pajaro River where we use this technique. We filter the data to just extract the pure diurnal signal, calculate the amplitude ratio once per day, that's shown here, apply that equation, and here's the seepage rate through the bottom of the Pajaro River in meters per day, estimated once per day. The beauty of this is that the time required to get from here to there is just about as long as it took me to explain it. There's almost no modeling involved. There's no big computer calculations. It's basically solving a little bit of algebra, and you get this flow rate once per day. So this is what we've applied to the pond at Harkin Slough, and here's the result. As far as I know, no one's ever made these measurements before in a recharge pond. There's four profiles. We didn't have them all instrumented, but we had a bunch of instruments put out here. This is 4 months of data from 2008, and these are infiltration rates in meters per day. This profile at this end, profile one, is shown in blue, and then down here in orange and red are these profiles. And to highlight the key result, it's shown here. We start out with a higher flow rate at this end of the pond. We get an infiltration rate that's like a meter a day up to 3 meters a day. That lasts for a couple of weeks, and then it plummets. It drops by about an order of magnitude, and then it stays slow, about a tenth of a meter a day. In contrast, at this end of the pond, we start out with a low rate, which increases during the recharge season until it's actually higher than the flow rate here. So what we're seeing is the center of recharge in the pond is migrating across the pond like a wave. It's sweeping across the pond over a period of 3 months. And you can see this even more easily if I look at 3 one-month periods. Okay, so I'm just going to look at those three periods, and we'll look at the pond spatially. Here's the seepage rates in the bottom of the pond in meters per day. The blue is a faster rate, and then the yellow is the slowest rate. So this was January 2008. A month later, seepage had increased here, decreased here. And then a month after that, this was the highest rate of recharge in the pond. So the center of recharge had migrated and moved across that pond. So why does that happen? Well, in addition to measuring the flow rate independent of Darcy's law, we also apply Darcy's law to calculate the hydraulic conductivity of the bed of the pond. And we do that by instrumenting piezometers with pressure gauges. So we measure the flow rate with our thermal method, we measure the head gradient with pressure gauges, and now we can solve for conductivity at each of the piezometers once per day. And when we do that, this is what we find. Here's the same four-month period. We see about a week or two of increasing conductivity, about an order of magnitude, 2 months of decreasing conductivity by two orders of magnitude, and then it levels out. Enormous changes in the properties of the bed of the recharge pond during the recharge season. So why is that happening? Well, there's a number of reasons. If you look at the literature on these recharge systems, the most commonly cited explanations for the decrease in recharge is a decrease in hydraulic conductivity. And that's typically associated with the collection of fine-grained sediment, infiltration of sediment into the subsurface, consolidation of the soil, and biofouling. That is microbial biomass building up in the subsurface and blocking off the pores. And we're working on evaluating all of these factors, so stay tuned for that. We do see some effect of this crust that accumulates in certain places of the pond, but this year we're going to have a much better quantitative estimate of where that crust accumulates and when. So hopefully we can nail that down a little bit more fully. I want to move on to water quality, which will be the last part of the talk. This is Calla Schmidt, and her dissertation is focusing on the impact of managed recharge on water quality. She's especially interested in denitrification. This is a process that removes nitrate, which is a common contaminant in surface and groundwater in basins that are developed either for agriculture or for human activity because of leaching from septic systems or landfills and so forth. So we have a number of sites instrumented in the pond at multiple depths. I'll show you that in a second. And Calla goes out repeatedly, day after day, during periods of high recharge to sample these different depths in different locations so we can quantify the water quality at the same time and at the same place that we're quantifying the flow rate, so we can relate the flow rate to the water quality. First, here's some water levels from the underlying aquifer during the 2008 recharge season. Here's the pond area, and then I've got the different monitoring wells schematically shown here in color. You don't need to worry about the exact correlation between the curves and the dots. I'll talk you through the plot. The main point is, before recharge begins, the general flow direction is to the southeast. Once managed recharge begins, we get reversal of a number of the gradients away from the wells. The general flow direction shifts a little bit to the south. At the end of recharge, it returns to the general flow direction indicated by the heads before recharge begins. So the mound builds up below the pond and water flows away from the pond, but not equally in all directions. We tend to see predominantly flow towards the north and to the south. In fact, I'll show you from the chemistry, we don't get any signal here in monitoring well 9. Here's some chemical records. This is 1 year of data with weekly sampling. And in this case, we've got pairs of wells shown here, and they're arranged in this plot the same way as they're arranged here. So that's 6 and 7. Here's 8 and 9 here. 4 and 5 are there. 2 and 3 are here. You don't need to know the details, but the point is that we can see a very different response to the recharge process. For example, well 2 responds very, very quickly when recharge begins. But in contrast, we see the signal from well 2 showing up at well 3, offset by a couple of weeks, whereas we never see the signal here at well 9, for example. So we can use this information along with the differences in heads to figure out, in general, where the water's flowing in the aquifer below. We're actually working on pulling the geological data together to do a groundwater model so that we can try to nail down some of the properties in more detail, collaborating with the Water Agency and USGS colleagues. What's more interesting to Calla is what happens during this initial infiltration in the pond to the nitrogen levels. So here she is with her rig out on a lovely day. It's not always this pleasant. We have the tubes running down into the pond, and then at each location we have multiple depths, either 2 or in some cases 3 shallow piezometers in the upper meter below the base of the pond, so that we can sample water as it flows downward and then as it continues to flow downward and track what happens to the parcels of water as they infiltrate below the pond. And in any given location, there's 2 or 3 piezometers, so she's sampling from the pond anywhere from 24 to 36 samples several times a week, generates thousands of samples. It was a lot of work to get the data, but it's pretty interesting. So here's a couple results that I think are kind of compelling. This is a chemograph. It shows the chemistry of water in the pond. That's the white curve. And then along the four profiles with the curves in color. And this is about a five-month period. And in most cases, we see a difference between the nitrate level in the pond and the nitrate levels that we detect in the piezometers just a meter below the pond. Okay. If you take the seepage rate through the base of the pond and you multiply by the reduction in nitrate concentration, that lets you calculate the load reduction. Okay. This is the amount of nitrate that goes into the pond that doesn't come out of the pond. Okay. It's being removed. And we're actually seeing about 50% load reduction in nitrate concentrations. Now, this is comparable to what people achieve with vegetative buffer strips for surface water or in some cases, for long-term constructed wetland operations where waters run across these systems in order to remove some of the nitrate. But one thing we don't know at this point is where's the nitrate going? Is it being adsorbed into the bodies of organisms, or is it actually being denitrified? And to look at that, we need to understand a little bit about this process of denitrification. So this is the process by which nitrate is eventually converted into dinitrogen. That's the nitrogen gas that we breathe all the time in the atmosphere. And that's a true removal of nitrate from the aquatic system. If nitrate instead is assimilated into the bodies of organisms, then it becomes ammonium, and then it can simply be released, go back into the environment when those organisms die. So that's not a true removal. It's more like a temporary storage. So we want to know whether that reduction in nitrate concentration is really denitrification. And the tool that we're using for this is the isotopes of nitrate. So here's your next little techie part of the talk, the last little techie part before we wrap up. I'm going to present data that use this delta notation. It's basically a way to measure the heavy isotope of nitrogen and the heavy isotope of oxygen in the nitrate. So it's not the oxygen in the water. It's the oxygen in the nitrate, and it's the nitrogen in the nitrate. And the reason why these provide a signal of denitrification is that most denitrification is accomplished by microbes. And when the microbes feast on the nitrate, they preferentially consume the lighter isotopes. And so the nitrate that's left in the water gets isotopically heavier and heavier. And it can be measured if it's converted into an appropriate form and run through a special instrument that can measure the amount of the delta 18O in the nitrate and the amount of the delta 15N. People also use this technique to fingerprint nitrate to decide where it comes from. But what we're going to be looking at is the trend of the data on a plot of delta 15N versus delta 18O, and there's a sort of a canonical trend of denitrification somewhere between 1:1 and 2:1, depending on where the denitrification occurs. And here's a plot of data. It's actually only part of the data set from 2008. I left off the groundwater data. Groundwater actually plots mostly down here. But in general, we get a very nice 2:1 trend that's typical of denitrification. This year, we're making some additional measurements of some of the gases in the water to really nail this down. But this is pretty much a smoking gun for denitrification. We can also see the increase in the heavy nitrate as we monitor at different depths. So we can follow the water and see the nitrate getting heavier and heavier as it moves downward below the pond. Because we measure the denitrification rate in the same location as we measure the seepage rate with the thermal method, we can make these plots, which you can't otherwise make. So here's a plot, for example, of the log denitrification rate as a function of the initial concentration of nitrate in the pond. And what this shows is a fairly consistent trend. There's scatter because it's a complicated system. There's differences in grain size. There's differences in the organic carbon content of the soil. There's other factors. But it's interesting that we get some kind of a coherent spread here, even at relatively high nitrate concentrations. This is half the drinking water standard. We're reaching very high denitrification rates. I'll show you how those compare to others in just a minute. So we do seem to plateau here. There seems to be a limit to the amount of nitrate you can remove from the upper meter of soil below that pond, but it's a pretty rapid rate. But the other plot, which is really interesting, this one surprised us. This is the denitrification rate, it's a log scale, as a function of the infiltration rate as measured with our thermal probe. So we get the data and the samples from the same place. And what we would have expected is that at higher rates of infiltration, we'd have essentially a lower rate of denitrification, that you might not expect that the microbes would have as much opportunity to consume that nitrate. Or you might have more oxygen, and they'd have less incentive to consume the nitrate. It's scattered. Again, it's a multivariate system, but we don't see the drop-off at the higher rates that we thought we would see. And instead, kind of looks similar, that we may reach some sort of a peak here, a plateau, at a relatively high denitrification rate. Now, these are crazy units. What kind of numbers are these? Well, here's a comparison. There was a study that came out in 2006 that looked at rates of denitrification in a whole bunch of different groundwater and surface water systems. And these are, it's a log scale, and there are all these studies. So this was a meta-analysis, a study of studies. And this is a log scale. So this rate is 10 times, or a tenth the rate as this, and that's a tenth of this rate, and that's a tenth of that rate. The average of all the Harkin-Slew infiltration analyses that we did is at the upper end of all of these studies. And in fact, these are plots of maximum rates. Okay, what these authors did is they looked at all these other studies and wrote down what's the highest rate they've seen anywhere in each study. Okay? And our average is higher than most of their highest rates. And in fact, our highest rate is way up here at the end. So one of the other aspects we're working on this year is trying to understand what is it about this pond that's allowing denitrification to be so efficient. Remember, we're only measuring so far the upper 1 meter. In this case, there's still about 30 meters to go till you get to the water table. Okay? And that also may help to explain why, even though we have mixed water quality, we tend to see a pretty big improvement in the subsurface due to the infiltration of managed recharge in this area. Now, part of the reason is because the ambient groundwater is so cruddy. It's already low-quality water. So anything you add that could dilute that is going to improve water quality. But we're seeing a large denitrification effect, and it would be nice to know what controls it so we can optimize for that in other settings. Okay, so the final bit is what we're trying to do to optimize. So last year and this year, we decided to try an experiment. And we wanted to prevent the buildup of the filter cake limiting recharge below the pond. So we put in a couple of trenches. We dug trenches that are a meter deep, about 5 meters long, and we used two substrates at the bottom, rounded pea gravel and redwood chips. This is based on some work done at University of Toronto and University of Christchurch in New Zealand, where people have put vertical walls in shallow groundwater aquifers, walls made out of wood chips. And they found that as groundwater moves through these reactive walls, that denitrification can occur. That you get a faster rate of denitrification in the reactive barrier sometimes than you do in the ambient system. So we decided to try to turn this on its side and see if we can enhance denitrification with the right kind of substrate. We've got riser pipes that are perforated. We put soil back on top, but the risers are to let water get into the trench, let it spread like in a French drain. And then we've instrumented like crazy below the trenches with thermal probes, water samplers, water content probes, pressure gauges, so that we can analyze this water and the conditions and compare it to the water that's infiltrating without a trench. So here's what that looks like. If anyone in this room can go to a tool shed, and they will rent you one of these. Okay, this is proof. They will rent these to anybody. And we went out and dug the trench and then started to put in our instrument shown here. Here's the redwood chips. And then here's the pea gravel and the redwood. And there's a riser pipe getting put in. This year, we're going to run them without these screens. We don't think we need these, and it limited the amount of water we could get in last year. And then we found a company that sells this geomembrane material that's used for sediment control. It's got about 6% open area. We fold this over kind of like a tortilla, so it covers that and prevents the infiltration of fine sediment so we can maintain the coarse conditions, the high porosity. So this is the gravel, and this is the redwood. And then here they are when they're all built up. And we have control sites adjacent to the trench site so that we can monitor here and monitor here and do a comparison between the conditions. So you'll have to stay tuned for this. We don't have any results to show quite yet, I'm afraid. So let me sum up then. In California, groundwater is a big deal. It's supplying, give or take, half of our freshwater supply now, and it's only going to become more important with time. We haven't even touched on climate change in this presentation, but we can maybe talk about it in the question-answer period at the end. But with more variable and less secure surface water supplies, groundwater has got to play a more important role as California's climate changes. Because aquifer storage and managing storage is going to be more important, managed recharge is going to become more important. And making effective use of managed recharge means we really need to understand the system. And there's a lot of work that's been done. I don't want to suggest that we're the first by any means to do these kinds of studies, although we bring in some new tools and some new ideas, but there needs to be a lot more research to understand how to optimize these systems, how to get more water in the ground, and how to protect water quality and enhance water quality during the recharge process. In the Pajaro Valley, we've looked at this Harkin Slough system. And what we found there is infiltration rates that get up to about 5 meters a day, but a reduction in recharge, or infiltration rather, as the hydraulic conductivity below the pond is reduced. These rates and properties vary spatially. It's not enough to just do a mass balance on the pond and get one number. Probably 90% of that water is going through 5% of the base of the pond. We don't know yet. We have actually wider distribution of instruments this year than last year, so maybe we'll get a handle on that. We can see significant denitrification occurring in this system. Now, it doesn't mean that all systems are going to show this level of improvement to water quality, but some might. And if we can figure out more completely what's controlling this, then maybe it's a technique that can be exported to other basins and other systems. There are a lot of other options in the Pajaro Valley that I'm not going to get a chance to talk about now, but I can answer questions about them maybe later, that will allow creative use of limited resources. The Pajaro Valley is not part of the statewide distribution system. The Pajaro Valley is going to have to solve its own problems. And managed recharge is probably going to play a significant role, not just this kind, but perhaps using streams and using stormwater retention structures and other systems around the valley. And on that, I thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.